Hi.
Hello.
Welcome back to Old Millennials, a deep dive on shallow topics from the late 90s and early 2000s. I am one of your hosts, Margot Poupard.
And I'm your other host, Emily Bejean.
Liars, scammers, flimflams, fraudulent behavior, swindlers, boondoggles. We've all been swept up in the latest college admission scandals. Emily, have you watched the doc yet?
Oh,
wait, we can get to that.
Have I watched?
Firefests and fake heiresses, which is why it's the perfect time for Emily and I to deep dive into one of our personal favorite pastimes, scams. Mm-hmm. So you have watched the college admission doc on Netflix, and then I sent you that WeWork trailer that looks incredible, a tech scam. Oh my God.
Oh, pouring the wine and popping the popcorn already for that one.
Oh my God. And then did you ever read the that Anna Delvey book I told you about, My Friend Anna, that was written about that, written by the Vanity Fair photo editor who got scammed by the fake heiress, who now will have a, I believe it's an Ava DuVernay, or is it Shonda Rhimes? I forget. But her miniseries is coming to Netflix.
I did not, but I should. I do remember, of course, the day, though, when Natalie Beach's article about Caroline Calloway hit the internet. And that was big because I believe she got an option too out of that article, where she had been Caroline Calloway's best friend.
Well, that's a perfect segue because I was going to ask you, do you have a favorite scam in the recent past, and or have you do you have a scam experience that you want to share?
Sure. So short ones for both. One, Caroline Calloway, because she is from Northern Virginia like me. So I always find it fascinating when people who grew up near me get into this kind of thing.
Two. I'm telling you, we need to make the definitive Caroline Calloway documentary. That's all I'm saying.
I would love to.
Watch out, Sundance.
We coming. In terms of personal scam stories, well, I'll be telling one a little bit later when we get into my scam. So I'm going to keep that on the wraps for now. How about you?
I think, you know, I get swept up in any scam. I think most recently the Alaria Baldwin scam. Like, I love like a harmless, victimless scam that just makes the other person look insane.
I mean, it's like what happens when a girl goes on study abroad for 6 months and then takes it to a steroid-driven level.
It honestly is an SNL sketch, and I couldn't rip my eyes away, and I just thought it was the funniest thing. And Alec Baldwin, of course, is just like aggro central. So even his lashing out, I think, is funny. And then he made some comment recently about how, like, oh, Gillian Anderson, like, switches accents. I'm like, because she's literally British. Like, what the fuck are you talking about, dude?
Yes.
Yeah. Alaria is, like, barely a yoga instructor. Like, let's relax. And, like, the fact that the ruse went all the way down to the fucking dog. Like, the dog was named like Diego. I'm like, you gotta respect the bit. Like, she really committed. We know people that like fully commit to something and then they start to fade away, but like she fully committed. Like, the stamina to keep up with it for this long is seriously impressive. So that's also why I couldn't stop thinking about it. But in college and like end of college, an ex-boyfriend of mine, he got scammed by a fake Nigerian prince email scam. I don't remember the exact details because it was very difficult to drag it out of him because he was extremely embarrassed that he was scammed because he thought he was above it because he's black. But he was not above it, unfortunately for him. He fell for it in such a way that he ended up – the punchline is that he ended up sending his $7,000 Nikon camera to some Nigerian prince expecting to get, I don't know, some sort of like money order, Western Union wire transfer or something that never materialized. And then he was just out, you know, I mean, between all of the fees and like trying to figure, like trying to recoup.
Grand.
I mean, it was almost 10 grand and he was like in debt for a long time. And I know that's not funny. He's fine now. He's a father. He's doing great. But I just remember I couldn't believe I had met somebody who had been genuinely scammed by a Nigerian prince, because you read those emails and you're like, this is complete nonsense. Like, and then our personal pet peeve of like every letter of every word in the sentence is capitalized. You're like, only a crazy person would do this. So like, why would I believe this? Or, you know, not a crazy person, but like only a scammer or like a robot or this is like some sort of like AI technology would behave this way or write an email this way.
I have fortune
and there was like
for
my
you.
Friend. Yeah. And like my friend, like, we've never met. What are you talking about? My friend, come on now, back up. But If you think I was going to pick the Nigerian print scam because it recently went through a resurgence, we found in our research in 2020 because everybody was home. And so there, you might have noticed an increase in telephone scams also. But even though I have this one degree of separation affiliation with a Nigerian print scam, and my therapist thinks that I could write for John Oliver, but sadly, I do not believe I am John Oliver material. So I did not go the Nigerian prince route because it gets, you know, very technical and I don't know how to make that funny. But this week's episode was actually kind of difficult for me to research. I went down a bunch of rabbit holes before I picked this fake Saudi prince story that doesn't technically adhere in our time frame, but it does run through it. At first, I really wanted to talk about Sally Struthers and her Feed the Children scam, but then guess what? Starving children? Not fun. Then I thought about Kathy Lee Gifford's sweatshop scandal, except whoops, that's also a fucking bummer. And as someone who had to have multiple people explain the GameStop stock thing to me like I was a five-year-old child, I still could not fully grasp what the fuck was going on. And I didn't want to babble on about penny stocks without really knowing what the fuck I was saying. And I don't necessarily think that reading numbers out loud is necessarily compelling.
Honestly, The Wolf of Wall Street did a great job explaining penny stocks, even though that was the 1990s. So I think you can go there if you want that.
But you know what doesn't feel bad? A fake prince who scammed Neiman Marcus, Fancy Hotel, and Ellen McPherson's husband, just to name a few, out of some money. Maybe you've already heard this story because it finally came to an actual real close. This guy has been arrested a lot in 2017, but somehow I had missed it. This is the fake Saudi prince, Jose Moreno, a.k.a. Anthony Gignac. FYI, I pulled a bunch of this from two Vanity Fair articles written by Mark Seal. So Jose Moreno was born in Colombia in 1970 and spent his early life living on the streets with his younger brother. His parents were unknown, as he and his brother were one of Colombia's 13,000 quote-unquote throwaway children lost in the shuffle of the country's drug war. When he was seven, Jim Gignac and Nancy Fitzgerald, a middle-class couple from Plymouth, Michigan, came to Botoga to pick up Jose and his brother through an adoption arranged through a local orphanage. He was then named Anthony Gignac. He was a bright kid. He could speak English fluently by the second grade. But like all bright kids, he had a penchant for a lie, particularly about his status. He told his classmates that his mother was so rich, she owned a historic hotel, and that his biological father was Dom DeLuise, which is my favorite lie.
Yes. What a perfect celebrity to pick for that. Just like so unsuspecting. So not what anyone would normally go for. So almost too wild that it could be true.
Exactly. Like, it's a perfect, like, wait, what? Well, I guess maybe. His lying switched from harmless, sometimes cute, to having actual consequences when he was in the sixth grade, though. One day, his mom gets a call. Your Mercedes is ready. Turns out Anthony had tricked the local Mercedes dealer into believing he was a Saudi prince whose dad was going to buy him a Mercedes. So an eager salesman showed up at the mall and picked him up and gave him a test drive. When the payment and the prince never materialized to pick up the car, a sheriff's deputy showed up at the Gignac home to find out what the fuck was going on. Things got worse when Tony's parents got divorced. His brother went to go live with his father, and he suffered a mental breakdown and spent time in two psychiatric hospitals and a halfway house as a ward of the state. By 17, he ran away. At first, he convinced an Arab family in Michigan that he was a prince and warned them his father's Secret Service would pay them a visit if they didn't take him in. Around that same time that he was living with them, he had one of his first run-ins with the law when he was caught telling the town that he was Prince Adnan Khashoggi, a real Saudi arms dealer and the world's richest man. He used stolen credit cards under that name to rent limos and ride around Detroit. 2 months later, Gignac turned up in L.A., where he was convicted of using a credit card with the name Omar Khashoggi to scam another limo company out of $8,600. So his new scam, when the fake credit cards didn't work, he does what every other scammer does. He pivots. He began to tell people, including his family, that in LA he had met a prince, a real prince, and had a sexual relationship with him. Now, there is absolutely no evidence of this ever being true, other than Saudi Arabia's well-known homophobic laws that could make this story very easy to make up. Gignac claims that he and the prince were found out, and he forced them to support him for the rest of his life or face the consequences, a.k.a. outing them. For the record, the Saudis have denied any connection to Gignac. In 2003, they said, quote, he was not a member of the royal family nor associated in any way with the Saudi royal family, but to Gignac's family, it all seemed very real. During his time in L.A., He ended up being dubbed by the LA Times the King of Fraud in 1991, but he still managed to rack up a $3,500 bill at the Beverly Wilshire Hotel, $7,500 in limo charges again, fraudulent purchases of Louis Vuitton luggage on Rodeo Drive. He promised his wealthy family would pay off his debts, even convinced the hotel employees to call him Your Highness, but he was eventually arrested and sentenced to 2 years in prison when he was 21. Gignac often pulled off his cons by being extremely loud and aggressive, angrily yelling at anyone who challenged him by asking, "Do you know who my parents are?" Which, as someone who witnessed Scott Baio saying this to an employee at a pet store, doesn't actually always work. Now, after his brief stint in jail, Gignac claimed to have legally changed his name to that of a real Saudi prince, Khalid bin Al Saud. In the Ritz-Carlton, he checked into the Ritz-Carlton in San Francisco with an Amex under the same name, where he once again ran up high tab with no way to pay. After 53 days in jail after that, he fled San Francisco without reporting to his probation officer and went to the Halukilani Hotel in Honolulu for Christmas, where he conned an unsuspecting couple into writing him a check for $8,500 for, quote, a share in an oil field in Saudi Arabia, which did not exist, according to court documents, and convincing another couple, Gilbert and Irene Goetz, that he had, quote, reason to fear for his life, end quote, and he duped them into paying his $20,000 resort tab.
Well, hello. Oh my God.
I didn't put this in here, but in the article, Mark Seals talks about how he called them to get, you know, confirmation, denial, whatever, a statement on it. And he said, obviously, it still stung because he believes Gilbert hung up on him and said, don't call me anymore. So... In July of 1993, Prince Khalid, quote unquote, checked into the Walt Disney World Grand Floridian Beach Resort in Orlando, where he ran up more than $14,000 in fraudulent credit card charges. He pled guilty, was given probation, and once again vanished. He repeats this ruse a few times until he's picked up in Chicago and extradited back to Florida over charges from a different hotel and Saks. In a testament to his scammer charge, on the way to the detention center, Gignac manages to convince the bondsman to stop by an American Express office, where he enters in tears, claiming his father, the king, would, quote, be most upset that he lost his credit card. American Express agreed to replace the card if he could correctly answer the security questions. What were your last two purchases? Gignac miraculously was able to verify the last two purchases on the card belonging to the real Prince Khalid, one in California and one in France. And so, being fearful of offending Gignac, they gave him an American Express platinum card with $200 million line of credit. It was later revealed in court. Yes, it was later revealed in court docs that he was able to answer the question because he bribed somebody at Amex with a couple of Rolexes. So with this new credit card and bondsman in tow, Gignac immediately booked two limos and embarked on a shopping spree. The bill came to $22,000. Next, accompanied by the bondsman, Gignac flew home to Michigan. He bought out the entire first class on a Delta flight. He visited a university where he promised to donate $1 million in exchange for a scholarship for a friend. Afterwards, he turned around, went back to Miami, and the bondsmen were completely dazzled. They were like, oh my God, this guy's a real prince. Like, this must all be an understanding. I can't believe that. But then, as they're on their way to the airport, then comes a call from American Express being like, hey, he's not a prince. He is currently committing credit card fraud right now. You need to arrest him. Gignac realizes that his current gig is up, and he throws the funniest Hail Mary. In the middle of LaGuardia with the bondsman, he sees a couple airport cops and yells, I'm Prince Khalid bin Al Saud. I've been kidnapped. He has a gun. If there are any of my loyal subjects here, please call the embassy and CNN. In 1994, Gignac did his own college admission scam. He calls Syracuse and tells them that he's interested in donating $45 million to the school. But could the university be a doll and wire a portion of the taxes for the donation, $16,000, to his account in East Lansing, Michigan? Syracuse did, in fact, wire the money. The bank account had been opened by Gignac's younger brother, who he had recently reunited with. And now they both get to spend some quality time together in jail as both men were convicted. And the fake prince was sentenced to 46 months for wire fraud. An additional 37 months were added to his sentence when he lit his cell on fire and covered the floor with shampoo, hoping to trip the guards and make an escape. That is some like Benny Hill level bullshit. Like you're going to like Home Alone kind of stuff. Like, okay, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to just cover this floor. I'm going to set some shit on fire. And then I'm just going to walk out of prison. The delusion.
It's going to work. Joe Pesci's the security guard. Daniel Stern's the other. Like, of course.
In a section I've called The Early 2000s Were a Dark Time for Us All. Like a lot of people in the early 2000s, Gignac returned to his mother's home in Michigan. After he was released, his mom had recently remarried, and he decided to hire his new stepsister as his, quote, personal assistant. He continued the lie, or maybe he began to believe it by now, that his lifestyle was being maintained by his royal boo, even going so far as leaving Western Union receipts from Saudi Arabia for $10,000 around for his stepsister assistant to find. In between scamming a local Atlanta doctor out of $5,000 by pretending to want to buy the Atlanta Falcons, which... If I was able to speak to him, I would need to get more details about that. He went back to Troy, Michigan, where he would later be arrested again for impersonating a diplomat. On January 3rd, 2003, after Gignac had charged over $11,000 to Sachs under his, quote, family account, which actually belonged to the real Saudi princess Fadwa Al Saud, and over $17,000 at Neiman Marcus to the real Prince Khalid, and threatened multiple employees of not respecting his royalty, he was arrested outside the mall and heard yelling, "You cannot do this. You must call the embassy." The real Prince Khalid was forced to fax a notarized letter to Neiman Marcus stating upon oath that he did not know Gignac and had not authorized him to charge to his account. While in jail awaiting trial, Gignac tried again, mailing a letter to Citibank. He demanded $3.9 million from the real prince's trust to be wired to him. On October 12th of 2006, he pleaded guilty to attempted bank fraud and impersonating a foreign diplomat. He was sentenced to 77 months in federal prison. So we're just going to speed through to the present day. In 2015, he teamed up with a man who'd take his fraudulent scheme up a notch. Carl Williamson was a 51-year-old British asset manager who was working out of his home in a small town in North Carolina. He was the perfect mark. He had no police record, experience in law and finance, a British accent that sounded positively royal, and a vast network of international connections. Before long, 26 investors were wiring a total of $7.9 million through various shell companies through Martin William International. In return, they thought they were getting a friends and family pre-offering for a pending IPO for Aramco, a Saudi oil company. By enlisting the aid of investment bankers in a couple of different countries, Gignac had graduated from a mere grift to what experts call white-collar fraud. It was, quote, a very complex and professional crime that would have fooled most people, even successful businessmen. Just as an FYI, the year that he was offering this friends and family oil stock deal like a fucking Macy's coupon, Aramco ended up getting shelved. They went public in December of 2019 and surpassed the $2 trillion mark on the second day of trading. But as all things in 2020, they dipped, but we don't need to talk about that. So much like Super Mario, when you get too greedy, you die. And with an inflated sense of self, Gignac entered into negotiations with Elle McPherson's ex-husband, Jeff Stoeffler, to buy 30% of the Fontainebleau Hotel in Miami for $440 million, of which he had zero. This is the where and when it all finally goes down for him. When Gignac's claims stop adding up, apparently sometime around him ordering prosciutto, ham, which is not allowed in Muslim religion, Stoeffler's people started to dig into his claims of having diplomatic clearance. He didn't. He only bought the fake license plate off of eBay and not owning the entire building that he lived in on Fisher's Island, a very Tony part of Miami. He merely was renting one of the cheaper condos. As one agent assigned to his case said, which is the same thing that Tracy Jordan said to Liz Lemon, "You know how I know you're poor? Your teeth." So in the end, Gignac initially pleaded guilty to both schemes, only to reverse himself at a hearing in July where his attorney successfully argued for him to have a trial by jury. I don't know why you would want to do that. In a case of don't hate the player, hate the game, Gignac turned his ethnicity into an asset by capitalizing on the fact that white Americans are ignorant and can't tell or be bothered to tell the difference between someone who is Hispanic and someone who is Arab, especially if they look rich, which he always was covered in diamonds, designer labels, driving fancy cars. One thing Gignac completely understood about the American experience for sure was the universal appeal of royalty. And that is the fake Saudi prince.
So this rings very clearly like the Saudi prince is not the only person to have done something like this, obviously. There was one very similar one in my where I grew up in the late 1990s where a guy posed as Steven Spielberg's nephew. His name was Jonathan Taylor Spielberg, because like who would have thought that's a fake name? He enrolled at my rival high school. So it was a Catholic high school called Paul VI High School in Fairfax, Virginia. And it turns out this guy who claimed to be 17 years old was in fact like a 28-year-old Iranian immigrant who was just kind of posing as the the nephew of Steven Spielberg, and was, after not showing up for several weeks, they actually called DreamWorks. The school called DreamWorks to talk to Steven Spielberg. And that is when they figured out that he was, in fact, not Steven Spielberg's nephew and was later found and arrested.
That's like an unsexy, never been kissed.
Very, very much. I do think one day if someone chose to make a documentary out of it, I'd watch probably.
See, I looked into that one too. And it's exactly as you present. There's not really like a ton of new or exciting information.
Yeah, it's it was funny though, because when I was in high school, this particular high school had a lot of scandals happening. And so this was the one that like, that was like the incident at their high school on top of everything else. Like it was just, you couldn't have made this up. Like, but it was, I mean, like it actually was. But yeah, it was fascinating. I remember it was still when it happened, cause I was like 11 or 12. Well, much like Stefan would say, my scam has everything. Career scam artists, Dionne Warwick, fake patois, infomercials, and Grand Theft Auto Vice City. Psychic scams were all over the place in the 90s with the rise of 1-900 numbers. The premise was simple. You would call the number on the screen, and for the low price of $3.99 a minute, a psychic would tell you everything you needed to know about your life and what the future had in store for you. For claiming to be able to see in the future, however, these psychics were not able to foresee the lawsuits, bankruptcies, and other woes that they would encounter down the line. These psychic networks were able to do a lot of business thanks to the infomercial boom of the late 1980s and early 90s. In 1984, the Reagan administration signed the Cable Communications Policy Act of 1984. With that, the FCC eliminated regulations that had been established in the 50s and 60s to govern commercial content of television. By 1994, an estimated 90% of all stations had or were airing infomercials. Hashtag thanks Reagan. Since there was deregulation around how many commercial cable networks could air, and cable networks needed lots of programming to fill hours since we're talking pre-prestige TV times, cable networks were happy and willing to have plenty of infomercials to fill the time and make money off of. During the 90s and early 2000s, there were two incredibly prominent psychic networks that you would probably saw infomercials for on TV. The Psychic Friends Network, aka the one that had infomercials featuring the Queen of Twitter, Dionne Warwick, and the Psychic Readers Network, aka the one that had infomercials featuring Miss Cleo. First, we'll go into Psychic Friends Network, since that's the one that dominated the first half of the 90s and was the OG in the psychic infomercial space. Psychic Friends Network, or PFN, was founded in 1991 and operated under a parent company called Information Communications, which was based out of Baltimore, Maryland. The company was founded by Michael Warren Lasky and was a direct response marketer, whose other infomercials included Making Love Work and a fishing device called the Helicopter Lure. According to this New York Times article about PFN from 1995, Mr. Lasky founded Information in 1990 and took a chance on the psychic business with $500,000 of his own money. Lasky, also known as Mike Warren, classic scammer characteristic, by the way, multiple aliases. Lasky was known for being a sports handicapper, specifically for horse racing. He was this career scammer using his handicapping skills to put together newsletters. According to the same New York Times article, while many of those business endeavors did well, several were accused of deceptive advertising. In Maryland, there were complaints going back to the 70s that the sports newsletter that he released, called Mike Warren Sports, engaged in, quote, unfair and deceptive trade practices concerning its refund policy. In fact, in this 1995 article, there's a woman who is a consumer affairs supervisor in the Maryland Attorney General's office, said that there had been 32 complaints in the office since 1988, many of them asking for refunds. Cut to phone psychics, who had been around for years, usually advertising on the back of magazines or personal ads in newspapers. But what separated the Psychic Friends Network over others is that they used infomercials to advertise their services and used call distributing systems, which meant that if you liked a psychic you had spoken to in the past, you could build relationships with those psychics and continue to call them. The other big differentiator was that psychics were available to talk 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It was a fairly cheap business to operate, as the psychics all basically worked from their homes and just needed landlines and took a cut of commission from the $3.99 a minute. PFN enlisted Dionne Warwick to co-host a talk show-style infomercial with famed psychic Linda Georgian. The two co-hosted these infomercials for 7 years throughout the entire run of the Psychic Friends Network's first iteration, and to this day, those are the most successful infomercials that have ever aired. Georgian had gotten her start in nutrition and later got into psychic business and published several books, including Your Guardian Angels, Use the Power of Angelic Messengers to Enrich and Empower Your Life, which, like, wild. I mean, all these psychic books that I came across as I was doing this research all had, like, a 10-word minimum title.
It's very Marianne Williamson.
Oh, yes, 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 it is.
Because it's always, like, long words like your journey into the light, : 17 ways that you can unlock your mystical powers that have always belonged to you and reside deep down within you. You're like, you could have said this in a lot less. I just, if you would like a note, that's my only one.
For you and your ghostwriter. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, Deanne Warwick decided to get on board with the PFN because she's actually a big fan of psychics and had been seeing them for many years. In fact, it was because of the advice of her astrologer friend, Linda Goodman, not related to Linda Georgian, that Warwick added an E to her last name in the early 1970s because Goodman claimed that the extra letter would give her, quote, positive energy and great success. Goodman is notable. Okay. She authored the first astrology book to make it to the New York Times bestseller list. That book was titled Linda Goodman's Sun Signs, published in 1968. Unfortunately for Warwick with an E, that meant that after having a monumental decade of hits in the 60s, with 22 top 40s in 8 years, her hit suddenly stopped and she only had one top 40 hit with the modified name. Eventually, Warwick would remove the extra E when she moved from Warner Brothers to Arista in 1979, and the hits resumed. Anyway, back to PFN. During these infomercials, you'd listen to Warwick and Georgian talk for 28 minutes and 30 seconds, which is a lot of time for infomercials, I found out. It's going to be that or 58 minutes and 30 seconds. And then you'd see the 900 number at the bottom of the screen and the $3.99 a minute. In a Slate article from 1998, when PFN filed for bankruptcy, more on that later, writer James Sorecki states that between 1993 and 1994, the infomercials aired more than 12,000 times. And at one point, Infomation, the parent company, was paying $500,000 a week to buy airtime on cable stations. At its peak, Psychic Friends was bringing in as much as $125 million a year because of those infomercials. And the company once employed about 2,000 psychics during their heyday. They became so wildly popular that they started even hosting some of these infomercials as live events or conferences, such as one of the infomercials I watched from 1996 that took place at the first ever Psychic Friends Fair at the Mall of America in Minneapolis. Wild times. It also featured famed TV announcer Rod Roddy as co-host, which you may remember him as the announcer on The Price is Right, who would say, Marco Poupard, come on down. Ultimately, though, it was diminishing returns, a saturation of the infomercial market, and poor decision-making that led to its demise. There had been a number of lawsuits the company had gone through because some viewers claimed that while they called the psychic line, they were put on hold and listened to recorded sales pitches that were, you know, at $3.99 a minute and for a variety of products and services not related to the Psychic Friends Network. Additionally, insiders such as famed mentalist Mark Edward, who once worked the overnight shift at the Psychic Friends Network, he actually debunked a lot of the industry secrets in his book Psychic Blues that was published in 2012. He described the organization as, quote, a psychic sweatshop and revealed that he gained the confidence of clients while working as a phone psychic because he could swindle people into trusting him just by using kind of people skills and intuition. In an interview, he told ABC News that he was taught techniques to keep his conversation super vague, entice the caller with the flattery. Quote, the goal was to make the callers feel good about themselves and keep them talking. And that he actually gave a 2.5 hour reading one time that the caller ended up having to pay more than $600 for. And this happened all the time, by the way. Like, people would get swindled into spending lots of money on these psychic phone lines. Eventually, in 1998, the Infomation Communications Company filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy, claiming it had $26 million in liabilities and $1.2 million in assets. In 2001, the bankruptcy trustees for the Psychic Friends Network sued MCI WorldCom Network for mismanagement of billing and collections and won a judgment of $7.5 million. In 2004, MCI would eventually pay $4.1 million. Up to today, Psychic Friends Network would later come back as a publicly traded online business in 2012 that would offer online psychics and had a web platform full of social media, e-alerts, and instant messaging. In 2014, like any good scammer company, the changed their name to the Peer-to-Peer Network to, quote, reflect its expanded new corporate direction into all facets of the booming peer-to-peer industry, or whatever that means. They're now based in Nevada, as many good scams are. So that is the Psychic Friends Network, and that gets us to about like 1998-ish. Cut to the Psychic Readers Network, which really should just be, you know, the Miss Cleo Network. You may remember Miss Cleo, a woman with a Caribbean accent speaking all sorts of truth to callers, telling you to call me now for a free tarot reading with a tagline on the screen that said, "The cards don't lie." By the way, I'm not going to attempt patois throughout this episode because my name isn't Chet Hanks, so you can just kiss
Thank
that
you. I mean,
idea goodbye.
I think you're making the right choice by not keeping it up. You just need to do it the one time, establish the accent. If true heads know, we don't need more than what you're giving. And also, we applaud you for not going full Chet Hanks, as having a patois accent, if you are white, will now be referred to henceforth.
Exactly. Miss Cleo was actually an American actress by the name of Urie Del Harris, who turned out was a bit of a career scammer at times, using the additional aliases Rape. And by the way, I pronounce her name Urie. It could be Yuri. I did not confirm this. Rape Harris, Urie Cleo Millie, Urie Del Harris, Urie Paris, Urie Del Harris, Cleo Millie Paris Urie, and then Cleo Millie Harris. She went through many names throughout her career. She was born in L.A. in 1962 to a Caribbean family, and in 1996 began operating a theater production company with her partner in Seattle. The first play was an autobiographical one titled For Women Only, and that's where she used the name Rhee Paris. There was a character in the play who was a Jamaican woman by the name of Cleo and would later serve as inspiration for the shaman character she'd portray in the commercials. This play was one of three she'd put on as part of productions in Seattle. Her last one was done in part with the Langston Hughes Nonprofit Advisory Council, who provided her with budget to which to pay the cast and crew of her plays. According to the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, she fled town and never paid most of these people. David Takami, then a spokesperson for the Seattle Parks and Rec Department, of which Langston Hughes is a part of, said that she made separate arrangements with her performers and cast and crew and apparently did not pay any of them. She also inappropriately charged various supplies and services to the advisory council. Another person who was interviewed said that apparently she told the cast and crew that she had bone cancer and that the cost from her medical bills would prevent her from paying the cast and crew up front, but she would write each actor and crew member a letter telling them what they owed or what she owed them at that time. Cut to the Florida-based, of course, Psychic Readers Network, which was owned by Access Resource Services, when they hired Urie Del Harris in 1997, where she would work through 2002. Harris, according to an interview she did with Vice, was no stranger to being clairvoyant and claimed that she, quote, came from a family of spooky people and that she came from a family of Obeah, which is another word for voodoo. Harris was just one of the many other psychics who worked for the Psychic Readers Network, but later she would go on to be the face of it. For the first 30-minute infomercial she did, she made $1,750 for the 2.5 days on set. In the documentary Hotline that she appears in, she says that the powers that be at the Psychic Readers Network decided they wanted Harris to go with this island shaman personality that came from a long line of Jamaican shamans. The website even said in her bio that she was from Trelawney, Jamaica. In the commercials, she would answer callers' deepest questions, such as who the father of their baby was. According to Miss Cleo, it was the one who cheated on you, and he also had a weird chin, but you already knew who the father was because your baby looks exactly like him. The psychics working on the line, according to Harris, were making somewhere from 12 cents a minute to 24 cents, so like peanuts. She made 24 cents a minute. You got calls based on a priority that was determined by how long you would keep people on the line. Harris stated that the minimum time to get on the priority list was to average about 18 minutes or more a call. The psychics who worked as subcontractors for the Psychic Readers Network, so if things went down, they could assume little to no liability, were given a script to follow and a simulated computer program to do the tarot reading. Bennett Madison wrote this amazing essay for the New York Times in 2016 called "I Was a Psychic for Miss Cleo," which I highly recommend everyone reads, where he talked about some of the identities he assumed while working as a psychic when he was just trying to make rent as a college student living in New York the summer of 2001. He answered an ad in the Village Voice for a, quote, phone actor, called the number where he interviewed with some guy in Florida, and then got the job. His most popular one was Cassandra, a husky-voiced Southern belle who called everyone honey child. which you can just imagine would be like one of the many people you'd come across if you were to call this number. In addition to the infomercials, there was an email marketing campaign tactic used, then a relatively new thing. People would receive emails saying, "Miss Cleo has been authorized to issue you a special tarot reading. It is vital that you call immediately." Roughly 6 million calls came into Miss Cleo over a 3-year period, with 1 billion in telephone charges assessed. The Psychic Readers Network was amassing an estimated $400 million a year during their peak. While all psychic networks had their share of troubles with the government, the Psychic Readers Network got into a whole lot more trouble than psychic friends because they were making a lot of false promises and using illegal tactics. In 2002, the Federal Trade Commission filed a complaint against the Psychic Readers Network because viewers were being told they were getting a free reading and then charging them. Of the $1 billion earned through the hotline, they had still not collected $500 million due to delinquent payments or stubborn customers who refused to pay. And here's where the fine print comes in. You might remember on the screen when you'd watch Miss Cleo, there'd be a whole lot of fine print right below the phone number that was very illegible on a non-L, like HD screen. The number on the screen was in fact a toll-free 1-800 number, but then the operator would transfer you to a 1-900 number. Then you were told the first 3 minutes were free, and then they charge $4.99 a minute. But according to a BuzzFeed article, The Legend of Miss Cleo, what would then happen was that the first 5 minutes were spent giving personal information and or staying on hold, which meant the psychic readings never actually happened while on the free time. On average, customers were being charged $60 a call. And this is where my personal scam story comes up. I called Miss Cleo as a kid and got into a lot of trouble because of said kind of $60 charge on the phone bill. And they do, in fact, keep you on hold for a few minutes to make sure you pay more, so that if there was ever a first free minute or two, you were guaranteed to go past that. My parents were not thrilled about this, as you
can
imagine.
Did you get through to a psychic?
I believe I did for about 2 seconds, and then my dad caught me, and I was like, bye.
Oh, okay. I was like, what did the psychic tell you? What was $60 at Psychic Friends Network? What does that get you? Apparently nothing.
Absolutely nothing. According to a Mental Floss article, when people would dispute their phone charges, Psychic Readers Network and Access Resource Services, the company that owned them, were alleged to have referred accounts to collection agencies. So even if a telephone carrier like AT&T canceled the charges, customers would still find themselves subject to harassment over unpaid debt. They would also bully people into paying charges that they had no obligation towards paying. And so began the class action suits started by people who were being charged fraudulently for calls that they had never made. The lawsuit started in 1999 in North Carolina, and then the subsequent suits would get filed in Arkansas, Florida, Illinois, Kansas, Missouri, New York, North Carolina, Oklahoma, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Indiana. The charges brought up by these states would be around the false advertising for free readings, the false billing for calls people weren't making, and the fraud around Miss Cleo's identity in some cases. Because Harris was named in the lawsuit in Florida, they would later release a copy of Harris's birth certificate showing that she had in fact been born in Los Angeles, which is when people found out about her real life and the Seattle Place scam from earlier. The FTC got involved and shut down the operation after receiving nearly 3,000 complaints from consumers. They demanded the Psychic Readers Network cancel $500 million of the $1 billion payments and also fined the company $5 million. They charged the company's owners and Harris's promoters, Stephen Fetter and Peter Stoltz, with deceptive advertising, billing, and collection practices. And I just have to take a moment to read the press release, just a tidbit of the FTC press release. J. Howard Beals III, then director of the Bureau of Consumer Protection at the FTC, stated, quote, "You don't need a crystal ball to know the FTC will continue to stop unfair and deceptive trade practices." And that's how you can be snazzy as a lawyer. Harris left the operation with zero charges and would remain mostly out of the spotlight, apart from an appearance here and there. She had a small cameo in Grand Theft Auto Vice City, although she couldn't use the Miss Cleo name and instead went with Auntie Poulet.
Okay.
In early 2005, Harris was reportedly appearing on television as Miss Cleo in used car dealership commercials in Florida. She'd also later come out publicly as a lesbian in the magazine The Advocate in 2006 and sat down
for
some—
I remember that.
Yep, yep. sat down for some interviews over the years, including one in 2009 for the Spokesman Review, where she stated that she still did readings in Florida for $75 to $250 and referred to herself as more of a voodoo priestess more than a psychic. She would later appear as a subject in the documentary Hotline, which followed around several individuals who had worked for different types of hotlines and was mostly about how humans felt more comfortable talking to strangers on hotlines than people in real life. Harris even had a podcast titled Conversations with Cleo. In these clips, whenever I saw any kind of video interviews with her or was reading any of these interviews, she always spoke with the patois, which in the Vice interview, they kind of asked her about that. And she just explained that it was something that came with old age. So it's kind of interesting. She did away with some of the Miss Cleo in her life, especially around the Psychic Readers Network, but very much kind of kept some of that identity along the way, which was very interesting to me. She also appeared in a 2014 Cinnamon Toast Crunch commercial. And I realize that's a little triggering,
topical.
Right?
Topical.
Yes. There's a lot of topical stuff, as our Chet Hanks did, in fact, call this summer, I believe, White Boy Summer, which...
Please do not stop mentioning him on
here. I will not mention him anymore.
If you want your Chet Hanks news, you got to go to Google or Twitter. We're not doing this here. I already see too much of him, which is like once every 3 months. And that's a lot.
That's a lot. It shouldn't be like a quarterly wine shipment. Those are fun. Chet Hanks is not.
Is not. Yeah, exactly. I did not sign up for that one. The Chet Hanks. The wine, sure. Yes, of course, but not the Chet.
Psychic Readers Network took legal action after that Cinnamon Toast Crunch commercial, claiming that the Miss Cleo character was their intellectual property and that Harris's use was a trademark and copyright violation. General Mills eventually pulled the ads. Harris, unfortunately, developed colon cancer, which spread, and she eventually passed away following a long illness on July 26, 2016, at age 53. A year later, Psychic Readers Network would go after Rockstar Games, which had produced Grand Theft Auto 15 years after the game's original release of Vice City, where she appeared as Auntie Poulet.
And ridiculous.
That is the story of the Psychic Infomercial Networks.
I mean, do you think that the psychic networks, or at least like the 900 numbers now that I see, because I rarely see like the fun psychic ones. It's always like the call up hot young singles in your area. It's always like hot people like half playing pool being like, call me. I'm like, that's not who's on the other line. We've already done this. Who is still calling these hotline numbers?
Apparently someone. And one of the things that was kind of interesting when I was doing my research is someone in one of the articles I read speculated that the psychic networks kind of came out at the right time because it was right during the Gulf War. There was a lot of uncertainty in the world. Like, people were really worried about what was to come, and they kind of just capitalized on people's emotions at the time who were pretty vulnerable.
Well, I think psychics and that sort of thing has now just moved to where everything is, which is just like on the internet. You can get an Instagram psychic to tell you whatever you want. I mean, it's a little bit harder to get the money out of you, I suppose, but I guess once they get your credit card, it's kind of all over. So yeah, it's just kind of moved around. Instead of somebody calling on a landline, you know, just get like a DM from somebody being like, oh, namaste, I had like a premonition, give me $40.
This has been a fun road down scammer lane. Are there any others that came up during your research that are honorable mentions?
Well, there was the Scientology, penny stock adjacent scam. The guy who had made money with Earthlink in like the 90s, he was a Scientologist. He was really close to, he came up with like L. Ron Hubbard or whatever, like was like a first person to like be taking classes from him or something to that effect. Because I don't have the notes in front of me, obviously. But anyway, so he eventually scammed like several million dollars out of like the more wealthy people who come to Scientology, like Giovanni Ribisi, and I believe like a couple of other people, like kind of, you know, doing the same thing that the fake Saudi prince was, just like, oh, you know, give me money and I will invest it in the stock that I have previous knowledge of or whatever. And anyway, it was a short-lived scam. And again, it was like sort of like a penny stock sort of situation where I was like, I don't really, I understand, but don't understand the semantics. And also all of the information on it was like pretty short. It's like, yeah, he did the scam for a couple of years. It worked. And then he got caught by like the SEC or something.
Yeah, I kind of remember that one. And it is interesting how many kind of wealthy people get swindled into this kind of stuff. Like, it is very, very interesting to me. I mean, I think for me, the scam that I was kind of thinking about, well, it's not so much a scam as it was a scam towards one, you know, certain groups of people, which is related to a couple of Hulu documentaries and HBO, is the one around Gypsy Rose and her mother, Dee Dee, the Munchausens by proxy.
Oh, right. The fake Make-A-Wish. But that was also, I mean, it's really sad. And it's like really dark. Is. This poor kid was, manipulated for forever.
Yeah.
And also into thinking that she had, I mean, it also ends pretty tragically.
Totally.
But like manipulated into thinking that she had all of these problems her whole life and then to suddenly discover that she's fine. I mean, that's crazy.
I don't know what I would do with that.
I mean, obviously, I feel like in so many ways, sadly, like her snapping makes tons of sense. But really just the – and it's kind of hard to – especially like with the Saudi prince, there was like a point where like it kind of seems like he fully – sort of like Aleria fully bought into this bit, except, you know, instead of scamming an actor into marrying you because you find out that they like – like women of Spanish descent or whatever. This guy is scamming, you know, Neiman Marcus or whatever, which, you know, you could trace it back to him for why Neiman Marcus and Saks have all gone under since.
Seriously.
But, you know, it's hard for me to feel bad for a big corporation. It's hard for me to feel bad for a billionaire developer who almost got scammed. Like, he barely dodged it. But I think with the Dee Dee and Gypsy Rose, I think she fully believed it because she had a mental illness.
Yeah.
And then as a kid, you don't know any better. And so it's just, I think some of these scams are fascinating to me personally, but are kind of harder to talk about because it's, you don't want to make fun of that. There's no way to punch that up at all.
And that's like with the Theranos, what happened at Theranos, for example,
that's also kind of funny.
It is funny in the sense of like these old conservative white men got super conned into going into
but
this.
But she was also sort of, I mean, like, what was that? Like, what are you doing? Like the whole thing, like from the hair to just sort of like her general vibe.
Yes.
Like, especially if you read Bad Blood, like she just seemed, I mean, she's a real character.
She is a character.
Of like Billy McFarland, you're just like, you are fascinating because I can't tell if you know that it's bullshit or if you believe it so much because you have to sell the bullshit. All we know is that you guys have like an inherent scammer charm that's sort of like serial killers. Sorry, you guys, to lump you guys together. You're like fascinated at how they're able to pull it off because like a bad marketing campaign, you're like this. There were so many ways and so many times where it was really close to like, how did it not get caught here? And how did it not get caught before it was a bigger problem or it got to this sort of problem? Like even the Saudi prince, like he was arrested a lot of times and went to jail multiple times. But every single time he was able to that's why cancel culture isn't real. He was like able to disappear, reappear, pretend to be a totally different person or even the same person. And people still bought it. Like rich people are kind of easy to swindle because in some ways they believe if you are able to get at them or to them, oh, well, you know, you must be who you say you are. And especially like people who have been famous for a really, really long time. I think it's easy to forget that people are scammers, you know, because it doesn't happen to people like you. It happens to other people, you know.
100%. And I think there is a component. I think we've talked about this before, maybe personally, and I don't think on the show. It's like, you know, in that Going Clear documentary about Scientology and in the book too, they talk a lot about how people continue to get, you know, swindled into these cons. And it's partially, I think people are so embarrassed to admit that they've invested this much time and money into a scam. Mm-hmm. That it gets to the point where there may be a point personally where they do not believe the lie anymore, but they are so in deep at this point that they think that by paying and continuing to invest, they can buy their way out of the shame that will come at one point.
It came up a couple of times in the Vanity Fair pieces that I was reading that various attorneys that the fake prince had managed to retain them, how embarrassed they felt that they were able to be scammed because they're like, I'm a fucking lawyer. Like, I deal with this shit day in and day out. I can spot a fake a mile away. And they couldn't. They all just got taken for a fucking ride. And one dude was like more embarrassed. One was like more pissed. Like, I fucking can't believe it. Like, I would never let that happen to me ever again. So yeah, I think that is definitely right. Like, people are just embarrassed to admit that it happens. Just sort of like people that get caught up like in Ponzi schemes. Well, not Ponzi schemes. Sorry, that I just misspoke. Like in multi-level marketing. They don't even realize that it's happening to them or they don't actually believe that it is that because they feel like no, if so-and-so says it's true, then it must be true, which is why it's so powerful. They recruit you on Facebook. They're supposed to be your friend. It's very easy to fall into the trap. And it's also kind of goes along the line, like you said, like Scientology, like that cult mentality, it for better or worse, like you just want to believe that something's true, because if it's not true, then it means like you're an idiot or you're bad or whatever. But, you know, it's not your fault for being a nice person or being, I don't know, receptive to someone who wants to deceive you. That's their whole intention. But I did find it most interesting that, yeah, one of the federal agents said, like, who had a lot of experience dealing with Saudi princes or royal families, that the number one giveaway for this guy was that he had crooked teeth. And he's like, all of the families get like plastic surgery and their teeth are perfect and they're super white. And like, they look like celebrities. And this guy had like, wanted to look like a celebrity, but you could tell it was fake. And so I think, but that comes from years of experience of having that this particular federal agent had, that attorneys and Saks Fifth Avenue. And like, I mean, retail employees are like the easiest people to yell at. Like the customer's always right. So
yeah, no, completely. They went after everyone. 100%. Yeah. No. And I, you know what this also made me think of, as you were talking about that fake narrative he constructed, made me think of like Andrew Cannon. Who like you've seen the Gianni Versace, Ryan Murphy
I haven't told this story on the. I thought I told the story on the podcast that my uncle, he stole my uncle's identity when he was like up here, and so when he had that short stint in San Francisco, and so when he got pulled over at some point in Miami when he was trying to leave or wherever he ended up getting arrested, he used my uncle's name. So yeah, no, I am aware of him and his schemes.
I mean, it's just, it's wild. If you can buy into the lie, it works. It's amazing when you really start to break down all these stories, how many parallels there are. And just like other people, like I just finished watching the Lance Armstrong 2-part ESPN 30 for 30 yesterday. And all of that is just scam, 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 scam. And it worked because he was a bully. So he bullied people into, you know, and there was an inspirational part because he really was a cancer survivor. That part was true. And he really did beat some crazy odds to survive. So you don't want to question a cancer survivor who keeps winning the Tour de France, because so many people bought into this narrative of him being this hero who had, you know, defied the odds to win one of the greatest athletic feats. Like it was meant for, you know, it just checked every single check mark. And like the country's need for patriotism and I don't want to bring it up again, but here we are, post 9/11 world. Like it checked every single box. And it's amazing because he still buys into it to an extent. He admits that he's an asshole and he did the wrong thing. But there is so many parts of it in that interview where you're just like, oh, you still believe yourself to an extent.
I also, you bring up a good point with the Lance Armstrong stuff, like that blood doping was a scandal and a scam. And that was also sort of the part that was the line that was difficult to differentiate when trying to pick something for this episode was like, okay, well, this was a scandal, but this was also a scam. And I just felt like sometimes the line was blurred because there were things that I thought were perhaps like a bigger scandal or had more of the tropes that you expect from a typical scam. But it turns out that actual scams are maybe a little dull because they're like money schemes, and that's not interesting to us. You know, it's interesting to us, like big characters who pull off confidence schemes like this and convince people to give them things by yelling at them. And I think that's like almost the perfect cover in a lot of ways. Is you would think, you know, me or you and me, like regular people, if we were going to attempt a scam, we wouldn't want to try to draw a ton of attention to ourselves by yelling at everyone in sight. But that's, you know, that is the reverse logic that you kind of have to take on, I suppose, or unconventional logic that you have to take on when you're like, you know what, fuck it, I'm going to go and get mine and be a fucking scammer.
100%.
Well, unless you have anything else to add, I think we're going to wrap it up for the week. Thank you so much for listening. We hope you enjoyed this episode of Old Millennials. And if you like this episode and you haven't listened to anything else, we suggest taking a scroll through our feed. We've got a lot of great stuff. And if you like everything that you've heard and you want to keep listening to us, please subscribe to us. And if you can, rate us and review us. And you can follow us on Instagram and Facebook at The Old Millennials Pod. And you can follow us individually on Twitter. I am at Marg She Wrote.
And I'm at Emily A. Beijing.
And until next time, we say bye-bye.
Bye.